The National Broadcasting Company presents the American Forum of the Air, founded 21 years ago by Theodore Granick and dedicated to the full and public discussion of all sides of all issues, coming to you from the famous Metronome Room of the Wardman Park Hotel in Washington, D.C. Now here is your moderator, Theodore Granick.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Every housewife, every family in the nation has a vital stake in the most bitterly debated legal controversy, the Justice Department's antitrust suit against the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, the ANP. The company contends that if they lose the suit, it will mean the end of the ANP, higher food prices for American consumers, and a threat to the American welfare and standard of living. But government officials insist that victory would lower prices, that ANP would not be destroyed, that living standards would go up instead of down. So today, the American Forum of the Air asks, is the ANP suit in the public interest? How will the outcome affect your grocery budget? What will it mean to your pocketbook? We have invited two distinguished gentlemen to try to answer some of the questions. On my right, Senator Joseph C. Omani, Democrat of Wyoming, a leading champion of small business. And on my left, Carl Beyer, noted public relations counsel for some of the leading industrial companies in the United States, among them the ANP. Now, Senator, let's open the discussion with a question to you. Is the ANP too big?
Bigness itself is not a crime, Mr. Granick. I would not pretend to say when business is too big. The description of the difference between bigness in business, which is good for the public, and bigness, which is bad, was best made by the only man in the history of the United States who ever served both as President of the United States and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. I quote from William Howard Taft, "If they use no other inducement than the constant low price of their product and its quality to attract custom, and their business is a profitable one, they violate no law. But if they attempt to use the preponderating capital and the sale of their goods temporarily at low prices to drive out the business of their competitors, or if they attempt by exclusive contracts with their patrons and threats of dealing except upon such contracts, or by other methods of a similar character, to use the largeness of their resources and the extent of their output compared with the total output as a means of compelling custom and frightening off competition, then they disclose a purpose to restrain trade, to establish a monopoly, and to violate the law." That's what William Howard Taft said to the Congress of the United States.
Spidey wants
it is the basis of this suit.
Spidey, want to answer Mr. Taft or Mr. Omani?
Well, I think I'd rather answer Mr. Omani, because I can see that the senator, who in my book has been one of the great liberals in the United States Senate over a long period of years, has been listening to the antitrust division. Because the senator, through all those years, has never made any bones of the fact that he thinks that big business is too big. Now, he hasn't maintained it was criminal, but he has maintained that it was too big and that something ought to be done about it.
You have not listened to me. I have never said
that
it was
too
big.
Senator, I'll quote you for 2 hours and 40
minutes. No, not today. No, not in the United States Senate.
About big business being too big and the concentration of assets and 7% of the companies and how many they employed.
Well, that's a very different matter.
I don't want to get away from this. I'm perfectly in accord with the idea that no American business should be allowed to grow big by the violation of any law, state, federal, or local.
Well, why not accept the injunction which the Department of Justice seeks merely to restrain you from doing the things again of which your company was convicted?
Well, now, let's look at that. The antitrust laws are very vague laws. They don't tell you, like an automobile law, that you mustn't pass a stoplight or that you mustn't go 40 miles an hour. They say, in effect, you mustn't drive an automobile in an improper manner. So you don't know whether you're violating the antitrust laws in many cases, and you can ask all the lawyers in the United States, until some court has told you what the law is. Now, the antitrust division...
Well, the Court of Appeals has told you what the law is.
That's right.
It has found you guilty of coercion.
That's right.
It has found you guilty of blacklisting. It has found you guilty of selling at unduly low prices to drive out competition and then fixing prices after you have driven it out.
Senator, you don't agree with the charge that the real basis of the attack on the AMP is the government's theory that it's been able to undersell competitors?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. If AMP will abandon these practices and undersell competitors only by efficient methods, believe me, the Department of Justice wouldn't have a leg to stand on, and no attorney general would bring a suit. But that is not the case. In this Danville case, in which the ANP was found guilty, and which it appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, there was a unanimous decision rendered by that Court of Appeals. A fine of $175,000 was assessed. The ANP paid the fine. And now the Department of Justice says, let's not have any more offenses of this kind. Why doesn't the ANP accept that injunction?
Well, now, wait a minute, Joe. Let's get the story straight and the record straight. The story of the Danville trial is not the whole story of the ANP and the Antitrust Division.
Well, how about
the... Now, let me tell you. The identical case that was tried at Danville was brought originally in Dallas, Texas. And in the sworn statement of the representatives of the Antitrust Division, it was identically the same case. In that case, the judge said that even if they proved everything they alleged, there was no violation of the law. So the government appealed to the circuit court. And two circuit court judges said this is vague, it's inflammatory, but you can go back to Dallas, there's enough to have a trial about. And one circuit judge said, it's no good. There ought not to even be a trial. There's nothing here that violates the law. So we went back to Dallas, Joe, and the court said, in conformity, you think that they ought to obey the circuit court? The court said, in conformity with what the circuit court has decided, we are striking out this inflammatory matter, and we're asking the government to tell the defendants what they're charged with. And the court gave him 75 days to bring in that bill of particulars, and it hasn't been delivered yet. And they went into court and dismissed their own suit.
Maybe we'll get it now.
And this time they said all the judges are wrong, the circuit, three circuit court judges and the district judge.
And now may I ask a question?
Wait, just let me tell you one more thing.
All right.
The peculiar advantage that these people have with all the power of all the people of the United States that ought to be used carefully against American citizens, they could look all over the United States for any judge that they thought agreed with their theories about what the Congress meant when it said you mustn't restrain trade. And they went up to Dallas, and there was a judge who didn't throw it out. But, Joe, he didn't bring in any such decision as you say.
Let's ask the Senator
he didn't
what Congress
say
meant,
we boycotted. Or yes, let's say what the judge said.
All right, now...
I've got it right here.
Here is your story, sir. Assuming that everything that you have said about Dallas is absolutely correct, you must acknowledge that what I have said about Danville, Illinois, and the Circuit Court of Appeals decision is correct.
No.
Why did you then not take that case to the Supreme Court of the United States instead of paying your fine? And if you were not guilty there, what about those 23 cases in the District of Columbia, in the police court, in which the ANP was found guilty of short weight, weighing the butcher's thumb when selling the steak?
Oh, and the
How
fan.
About
you
that?
Can turn a fan on the scale, too, and get some extra weight on it. Well, in the first place, I sat through the Danville case, and Judge Lindley made no such decision. Judge Lindley said that the ANP did one thing, which, if they had not done, probably everything else they did would have been legal. He said there was one thing that tainted the operation of the ANP, and that one thing was that our subsidiary, dealing in fresh fruits and vegetables, acted as both a buyer and a seller. He said that was wrong. He said that was a violation of the law. And I'm not prepared to say to you that Judge Lindley wasn't right. But all I can say to you is that under the Perishable Commodities Act, which was passed by the Congress of the United States, nobody can engage in trading in fresh fruits and vegetables without a license from the Department of Agriculture. And the Department of Agriculture had not only issued such a license, had not only never made a single complaint that there was any violation of proper trading under that license, but they even issue licenses that people can engage as dealers and as brokers and as commission merchants. I think they know something about the agricultural business. But, Joe, let me answer your thing about the circuit court. I admit that Judge Shea Minton adopted a good deal of the language of the government and said that we did some things that were pretty bad. And you say, why didn't we appeal to the Supreme Court? So we read the decision of the court, and we said the best thing to do here, and this will be all over, and we won't be in court, and we won't be spending millions in legal fees, is to assume that the judge is right, even though we think he's wrong, and to do everything that he says we ought to do, and to discontinue every practice that he thinks we ought not to indulge in, and we did that and paid the fine.
Senator?
Now, is that the reason why in Massachusetts, in another case in Connecticut, in another case in Rhode Island, in another case in the state of Maine, when you were charged with fixing prices, you pleaded noli contendere and paid the fines? Is that the reason why you pleaded noli contendere in the Southern District of New York, and why you also acknowledged the correctness of the government's case in the District of Connecticut? There are case after case, including the case of the Federal Trade Commission, which ordered A&P to cease and desist from its violations of the Robinson-Patman Act. And while that case was in progress, while this Danville case was being tried and that cease and desist order was outstanding against you, you were taking rebates from Borden Company and from the Bowman Company in Chicago to the tune of $1,200,000.
We're not even a defendant in that case. The department is suing those companies, and if they thought we had done something wrong, they could have sued us.
The grand jury found that that was the fact.
No, there hasn't been any decision in that case.
You and I could spend the whole 15 minutes
let's
saying
argue the public
you
interest.
Did and you didn't.
That's right. Let's get to the public interest.
Let's argue
now,
the public interest.
First, my first statement to you is you ought to accept the injunction and say, we won't do these things anymore. If you didn't do them, the injunction does you no harm. If you don't intend to do them, the injunction does you no harm. Now, what are the other...
Let's debate that a minute.
Well, are you willing?
A&P has never had an opportunity to say, we'll accept the injunction. The boys down there said, what you must do...
You have the opportunity to say it now.
We offered
it. Are you willing to do it now?
I'm sure that the A&P will accept a consent decree in which they undertake not to violate ever any law of the United States, and they don't believe they ever have.
And that will be specific? You'll accept such an injunction.
I'm sure they will. I'm neither their legal counsel nor the trustee of the company.
It will include the Federal Trade Commission, will it, sir?
Well, want me to tell you about the Federal Trade Commission?
Well, no, but will it? Will the injunction include
that? Did you vote for the Robinson-Patman bill, Senator?
I did.
Yeah, and you don't know that it cost the American people $6 or $7 or $12 billion in the food and the clothing and the drugs that they do not get?
Nonsense.
I'm not against
that
the Brannon bill.
Nonsense.
I'm not against the Brannon bill for the small retailer. I'm for the small retailer.
You're
I think the A&P has
about
been
something
his greatest
very
friend.
Different now.
Oh, no, I'm not. I'm just keeping you on the beam, you see, because you and the rest of the Congress, and it's within your power.
Well, if the courts could keep A&P on the beam, it would be a great benefit
the
for the consumers
We're
of the
on
United
the beam.
States.
We say, we're on the beam, we paid the fine, we have discontinued all those practices, and we say this is like a case where you fine a man $10 for passing a red light in the traffic district, and then you say, and now we must cut off the man's arms and legs and prohibit him from ever being able to drive an automobile.
All right.
Again.
Now then, Mr. Beyer,
and
you
what
come
they
here.
Asked for in this complaint, not you, an injunction, Mr.
You
O'Malley.
Come here defending an organization which has been found guilty in the federal courts, in the trial court, in the Court of Appeals, you haven't appealed to the Supreme Court, in the Federal Trade Commission, and in the Police Court of the District of Columbia. Now, you talk as though this were an organization, just a beneficent organization created for the purpose of distributing food to the housewives of the nation. You are representing, sir, an organization of holding companies piled one upon the other, an operation under 17 or 18 different aliases, manufacturing, distributing, warehousing, brokerage, and tea companies, operating in 39 different states, with sales totaling about $2
billion.
$2,700,000,000. Isn't it wonderful? And in the trail which has been followed, you have been crushing competition. You have been operating at a loss in New England and in the Eastern District, operating at a great profit in other states.
Well,
I have your exhibit here.
Oh, well, I can give them to you.
The exhibit which your company filed in the trial. This is the case, this defendant's exhibit, 499 at page 1, showing that you planned it in 1938 to operate in New England throughout 1939 at a loss.
At an operating
at
loss.
At a loss.
Not a profit.
And that in the central western states, where you were doing exactly the same number of sales, 122 million sales, you were planning to operate at a profit.
Now, look.
Let Mr. Byer answer that. Go ahead and take a long answer.
I think you get reduced here to the de minimis. Here's a company that has 10 to 12 million, 15 million individual sales transactions a week with 10 or 12 million women. And in one instance, it was found that 29 sales, that's the total out of all the billions of sales that a weight inspector said somebody was shorted.
In the District of Columbia.
And in the District of Columbia, the same people said that we conspired to reduce the price of bread, and Judge Allen Goldsboro said this is the worst case I've heard in 40 years. Any good trial lawyer would have told you there's no evidence at all. They accused us of conspiring to reduce the price of potatoes in Carolina, and the judge says you can't make a case without facts.
Well, of course, all the $2 billion worth of sales weren't wrong.
But here's what I want to ask.
I'll acknowledge that.
I want to ask you, Joe, if we're putting all the retailers out of business with these unfair methods, how is it that there are 400,000 of them in the United States and that they're rushing forward literally by the hundreds to tell the antitrust division that they don't need any help, that we're the best friend they ever had?
You know, they're advertising that effect.
Well, advertising in the newspapers.
Well, if the farm answer, organizations, may I answer
your
question?
Wait just a minute. The farm organizations that we're supposed to hurt, including the Farm Bureau Federation, are passing resolutions representing millions of farmers that this case is no good. The consumers have increased our business $2 million a week, so evidently they don't think we're a lot of crooks. And the thing... And I want to tell you that if any lawyer or any political leader or anybody else thinks that 50 million American women don't know whether they're getting right weight or fresh fruit or spoiled meat or good meat, they just don't know the American woman. She gets her money's worth, and she's made the A&P the greatest retail company in the history
well,
of the world.
Well, why not try it in the court?
Gentlemen, how about letting the consumer ask a question? Go ahead, Miss Penn. You have a question there?
Mr. Byer, do you believe the fines paid by the Atlantic and Pacific Company are sufficient deterrents to prevent a recurrence of the violations of the antitrust laws?
No, I don't. But I don't think the people who run the A&P need that kind of a deterrent, although they've paid the fine. In the first place, I know that they went to the department and said, you tell us what to do, and we'll do it to obey this law. And the department says, there isn't anything you can do. It's so terrible, you've got to break this company up and quit manufacturing and have seven different companies, and nobody that ever had anything to do with the company before can be in the new company. Now, let me answer your question about $175,000. As the courts have said over and over again, and the antitrust lawyers have said over and over again, there is only one motive to violate this law, and that motive is greed. You want to make more money. You get together with your competitor. You try to raise the price. Now, the whole history of the A&P negates greed, and I just want to show you something here. What kind of people are these people who run the A&P? John Hartford, 77 years old, works 5 days a week. George Hartford, 85 years old, works 5 days a week. B. beyond rich beyond the dreams of avarice because the American people have made them rich. So what have they done for the American people? I think the best test of an employer or of a big business is how he treats his people. Does he try to make his profit out of the sweat of the brow of the people that look for him? Now, just take a look at these charts for a minute. There's the picture of A&P employment. I showed these to Senator Omani. He's familiar with them. In 1933, this company had 87,000 employees. Today it has 112,000, or the number has increased 29%. The cost of living for the American people in that period has gone up 82%. Now, did the Hartfords just try to keep a little ahead of the cost of living? No. Their payroll has gone up 195% over that period of years, and they're paying an average in the grocery business, which was the worst paid business in America a generation ago, $60.50 a week to all employees, not including any executive employees of the company.
Senator, I'd like to comment on that chart. Go ahead, Senator.
Let me say this, Theodore. The Standard Oil of New Jersey had just such a monopoly as this. The Supreme Court of the United States decreed that it should be broken up. The result of it was more business and lower prices to the consumers, more profit to the operators. We had, instead of one gigantic company out of the Standard Oil Trust, we had almost a dozen new companies. Congress of the United States, when President Harding was in the White House, passed a law compelling the Packers to give up their ownership of the stockyards. The result, it was signed by Mr. Harding. It was unanimously passed by the Congress. The result was cheaper prices of meat for meat to the consumer and better prices to the producers of cattle. The same thing would happen if the A&P were compelled to separate manufacturing from retail, if it were compelled to divide into its seven divisions so that it cannot now throw its losses into one area of the country to sell temporarily at a low price and make profits in another area of the country so as to suppress competition and work over the consumer.
Let's hear what another consumer has to say. Go ahead, sir.
Senator O'Mahony, if A&P is hurting competition, why are so many small independent grocers rallying to its aid?
I have no evidence that so many are. And, of course, I might say to you that the Department of Justice has been following A&P for 10 years, and that has been very helpful to little business in competing.
Why do you want to comment on the competitors?
Well,
supporting of you.
The fact is that competitors all over the country, at their own expense, have run advertising in the newspapers saying that they don't need any help from Uncle Sam or from the antitrust lawyers. There's a typical advertisement from farmers down on the Jersey coast. More than 1,200 Atlantic County farmers protest government action against A&P. And strangely enough, they say they rise to the best friend, defense of the best friend the farmer ever had. Now, the fact is that the A&P has benefited its competitors in the retail field and not hurt them.
You know what bothers me about this, Carl, is that if your company is such a perfectionist as you describe, if it's so beneficent, so kind, so concerned in the interest of the public, what have you got to fear in going to court? Why do you have to spend $5 million in advertising in the newspapers? And here in the city of Washington, the newspapers into which you place the advertisements decline to receive the advertisement of the little business people.
No, they've run all over.
Are you trying to do anything about getting the trial in the papers instead of in the court?
Well, now, wait a minute. We're not afraid of the trial in the courts, but we have 10, 12, 15 million women dealing with us every week. I don't think American women are the kind of people that would want to deal with the kind of a company. Now, suppose we had waited a year in Washington where they said we were raising the price of bread, that we were the kind of people that would take bread out of the mouths of poor people. It took a year for that to come to trial. What would have happened to our business in Washington when Judge Goldsboro said at the end that the evidence showed that we sold bread cheaper than anybody else in Washington, not higher? What would have happened to our relations with the farmer? And I don't think we have to sit silent under these, plus the fact that we're not spending $5 million, Joe. we're running stories about this in the regular space that we would use if we were running our price ads, and strangely enough, the public is so interested in it and believes us as against our adversaries that business gets better every day.
Now then, will you prepare an ad? You're a skilled public relations man.
Thank you, Senator.
Prepare an ad tomorrow or next week on the Southern New York case where you pleaded guilty.
I promised on to
the Connecticut
story
case,
of every case.
On the Massachusetts case.
No, we didn't.
On the Rhode Island case.
The
on
the we
Maine
didn't plead
case.
Plead guilty in any of those cases.
Well, you filed a nolo contender. You said, no, we
because
won't do
the practice,
it. But
we had
on
no way.
On the short waiting in the District of Columbia, you had a trial and you were found guilty in the police court.
That's right.
Well, put the ad about that in the paper.
That's right. There was a...
Did you want to ask you, but we want to go into the summary period. Senator Omani, do you want to sum up? We each have a minute.
Well, let me say this, that we are struggling here with the great question of centralism. The United States is either going to have decentralization, self-government in the regions and in the states, or it's going on the road to big government. The AMP, a typical national organization, operated from a central office in such a manner that little competitors can't keep pace with it, is leading down the road to socialism. That's why I'm for competition and for little business and for restraints upon predatory big business.
Thank you very much, Senator. Mr. Byer.
I say to you with all the sincerity of which I'm capable, I've represented many American companies, I have never known a company that tried as hard to obey every facet of every law, local, state, and federal, as the Great Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company. I say to you with all the sincerity of which I'm capable that no little retailer has been hurt. The little retailer who used to work 7 days a week and work 5 and 6 nights a week today has a big supermarket and makes $250 or $500 a week. Due to this competition, he gets his groceries cheaper and the wholesaler gives him a better and cheaper service. And I just add this, that the proof of all this and that we have not restrained competition, that the charge emanates against us because we are too competitive, is that in all the things you buy, the wife takes a dollar to any store, clothing, household utensils, for anything for the children or the husband. She gets 62 cents worth of goods, and she gets 38 cents worth of the cost of distribution. She can go into any grocery store in the United States, and due to the competitive pressures of the A&P, and everybody in the grocery business will tell you it's so, she'll get 85 cents worth of food, and she'll only pay 15 cents for all the costs of distribution, and she can do it in 1,000 grocery stores that are not A&P grocery stores.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. We're listening to a discussion on the A&P case. Our speakers have been Senator Joseph C. Omani of Wyoming and Carl Beyer, the noted public relations counsel. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.